The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Matt Lieb.
And I'm Vince Mancini.
And this is
Pod Yourself
The Wire. The Wire podcast, where Vince Mancini and I go through every single episode of The Wire
and talk about it.
Thank you so much for joining us once again for another terrific episode of the world's only The Wire rewatch podcast. The Wire, a show about saying fuck the bosses, where the bosses also include your fucking ex-wife, dude. What is up with my ex-wife?
That's been Aaron Sorkin's MO all along. I don't know.
Before we go any further, just a reminder, 5 stars and a review, please, on all of the platforms. Give us 5 stars on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, all of that stuff. Anyways, let's get into it. Today, Vince and I will be talking about, from season one of The Wire, episode 5, The Pager. And our guest today, oh, wonderful guest. You know her. You love her. She is a comedian. You've seen her on Comedy Central. She has a special out called Figuring It Out. It's on Comedy Dynamics. You can get it right now. Ladies and gentlemen, Katrina Davis is here.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be back.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you're back. You were on... Yes, you are on our Sopranos podcast, and we loved having you, and you're a good friend. And we said, you know what? Maybe she also has seen some of The Wire, and you have, yeah. So that's perfect. And we want to ask, you like The Wire?
I do. I was born in Baltimore.
Yes, wow.
So
that's right.
I have a very mixed relationship with the show, because I hear things that I love and that remind me of things, and I see things that I love and remember about it, but then also a lot of that stuff is still like that, and this was made a long time ago, so
that is one of the more depressing things about the show, is watching it, realizing it came out 20 years ago and nothing has changed. In fact, it's gotten worse.
Yes. Like, in my family, we treat The Wire like Roots. Like, it's not really fiction. And my mom won't watch it because it's too depressing. And she gets it. Like, she's like, I know what happens. I don't want to see this.
It reminds me of, like, in Jewish families, I don't know if this is true of all families, maybe just a few, but everyone has a copy of two copies of Schindler's List, one that they touch.
In case the Nazis take one of them.
Right. One is one you watch, and the other one is one that you'd never open because it's a special version. I don't know why that is.
Really? But is it a director's cut, or just the same thing, but like a mint condition one?
It's a mint condition one. I could be just talking about one specific friend I have who did that. And I always thought, like, oh, it must be like, some sort of Jewish thing that I didn't know about.
I like the idea that Jewish families keep copies of Schindler's List like Jordans. Like, they just keep one pair to not crease.
Yes, exactly. Honestly, I think that's what it is. It's like, no, that's our mint condition version. As soon as you take it out of the box, it loses all of its value. So that's just how it is.
But that one's never been driven off the lot.
Yeah, right, exactly. It still has that new Schindler's List smell, which is not a Not a good smell. But yeah, so does that mean like when you're watching the show, are you like specifically attuned to actors who get the accent and actors who don't get the accent?
Okay, well, here's the thing is my family sounds very specific and not really like anyone on this show. Like, not at least in these earlier episodes. Like, I didn't think about it until you mentioned it, but I don't, are any of them trying to? I don't think any of them are trying to. They're kind of just talking in like a...
They're doing most
vaguely
of them are
East Coast maybe thing, but they don't sound like they're from Baltimore to me at all. I didn't really pick up anyone yet.
Yeah. I'm thinking like the only person I can think of that sounded Baltimore-ish in this is like Dee's girlfriend maybe. And I think that I don't know if she was the local, but.
And it's D'Angelo know if she also. Sounds like she's from Baltimore or just sounds the most hood. Like everyone else is kind of just, she has like the most lines where you have like some personality or like inflection to her voice. Everyone else is just trying to sound hard all the time.
Yeah.
So maybe you can't tell.
For me, the only way, like the main way that I can tell early on is anyone who says two as in Q when they do that little thing.
Yeah.
Right.
That's how I know what's going. Like, I'm like, oh, that's Baltimore. So like, I know D'Angelo has that, but I think so far in this series, there's not a lot yet of the Baltimore accent.
I was at work in Florida and like said hello to a maintenance man. I went, how are you? And he was like, where are you from? And I was like, why? I am from Florida. And he was like, you're not from Florida. And I was like, oh, well, I was born in Baltimore. He's like, that's what it is. Like immediately called me out. Yeah.
There is a version of like knowing accents, like regional accents too well, where it sounds like it sounds like you're doing race science where you're like, I know you ain't from these parts. Oh, I can hear it in your voice.
It sounded so telling. It sounded like his ex-wife was from Baltimore. Like it was so like somebody that he lived with. He was like, wait a minute. What was that? That person owes me $500. Like that was how he turned around.
Nice. Well, so do you have a favorite character or someone that you really love on the show?
I love Wallace. And I always loved Wallace, and I didn't realize it was fucking Michael B. Jordan until this time. And then I had a full-on conniption and was like, oh my gosh, I love him even more now. That's freaking Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah, especially in this episode. I feel like this episode is when you really see Wallace as a child. He's literally in the pit. Waiting for, you know, fiends to come up and buy drugs. And he's playing with like an action figure.
Yep. This is, I feel like, the full pivot of him, like, like being forced into manhood by the things that happened in this episode. Yeah. And the beginning of the next one, you love him even more. But like, I wrote down at one point, black boys in the city aren't allowed to be children long enough. Which isn't funny, but it was just like I kept watching all of these things happen to all of these young men.
Yes.
And just being like, this is what happens. And then you just skip all of this. Like, that's the last time Wallace will play with a toy. And it's so upsetting.
It is. It is. And that I had the exact same note watching this was just like half of that scene where like Bodhi throws a 40 at him and just starts yelling at him for playing with the toy.
Easy to see why niggas come around here stealing our shit.
Like half of it is that like Bodhi is, you know, trying to, I think, maybe whip the pit into shape and be like, look, I'm someone who takes charge around here. But the other half is just like, it is showing like you can't be a child. You're not allowed to be a kid.
No, it's a sign of weakness.
You look at and you look at Michael B. Jordan at this age. I'm not sure how old he actually was in when he filmed it, but he looks like
he's
a baby.
Little.
He looks he's little. How old I looked when I was about 17, which makes me think he was about 13 and 12.
I was going to say like 14 tops.
Yeah.
And I know that they put him in like jackets and stuff that make him look even smaller because he has like these oversized. But yes, he and his face look so young.
So young.
I feel
so
like he
young.
Still has like cheeks like you do before you like have a growth spurt into teendom. Like
I I one time heard someone say, I think it was a South Park joke where he was like, nah, you guys ain't adults. You're clearly children. Your lips is too full. And
like cherubic.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, that is a thing, though. The younger you are, the more full your lips are.
Yeah.
And I was like looking at Michael B. Jordan, and I was like, cherubic. He's got like round cheeks and these like full lips, and he's like, he looks like a baby who should be playing Power Rangers with his friends, but, you know, he's just born in the wrong circumstances.
Well, what you're saying about that scene, I feel like it was a domino effect, because old boy that threw the bottom at him is like, what, 17?
Yeah.
And I feel like he was 16. Already trying to flex because he didn't feel like he was man enough. So then he exerts that on someone even younger than him. I was like, none of y'all can even buy 40s legally. Like, all of you are too young to be feeling like you should have to do this.
Yeah. This episode has a lot of like kids in adult situations where you realize as you're watching it for the first time in five episodes, I'm like, oh, these are actually like literal children. These are children. We're going to get more into that in a second. But first, before we do, we must, of course, play the theme song.
Pod. Through the garden, you better watch your back. Well, I beg your
pod.
Want to stay in
podcast.
Track. If you
pod
to Jesus, you'll save your
the wire.
Soul. You gotta keep the devil
pod.
Down.
Pod.
Down in the hole.
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 Podcast.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, and everyone else, today we are going to be talking about, from season one of The Wire, episode 5, The Pager. Now, this episode premiered on June 30th, 2002. Vince, can you break us off a little piece of that synopsis that was totally not written by me?
I sure can, Matt. I love synopses that are written by the official people at HBO. Ergo, the relationship between stick-up man Omar and his lover Brandon starts to sour when Omar realizes that Brandon cusses a lot. After blinding a 14-year-old for leaning on his cop car, Roland Presbyluski totally redeems himself by cracking a code meant for children.
That's right. Those are the things that happen in the episode. That is the synopsis. And what was happening at the time that this episode came out, Vince?
Oh, Matt, I think what you're trying to say is that all art has context from... You know what I mean, how we do this. We've done it a few times.
It's a bad time for newspapers. The news hole is shrinking as advertising...
I'm sorry, I didn't let you finish.
I was just going to say the name, at least. We're going to do the back-in-the-day machine.
Okay.
Dollars continue to decline.
There ain't no back-in-the-day
machine tells the tale, son.
There we go.
Yeah. For this episode, we're going all the way back to June 30th, 2002. What a year. What a day. Bush again, we covered this last week, but apparently he's still talking about it. He's still going to issue his strike first policy.
That's right.
Yeah, going to
strike first, strike hard.
No mercy.
No mercy.
This is when the USA became Cobra Kai. We were
that's
about
right.
to do
I was about
some...
to say, that sounds like a no fear shirt. What is this?
We were declaring the right to do aggressive war on other people because there was vague threats towards us, because aggressive war was, you know, specifically banned by like the Nuremberg trials and the Geneva conventions and all that. It was a bad
Geneva
thing.
Geneva conventions.
It was both.
And so we decided, you know, it was basically between 9/11 and the war in Iraq. It was basically like, what, a year and a half of Bush just being like, don't make us do it.
Yeah, why are you hitting
don't
yourself?
Don't make us invade. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they kept saying, please don't.
Yeah, please, we no, like, but don't do that. Don't do that.
As we were slowly like, putting on our army boots, don't make us do it.
In other news, new FBI alert warns of threat tied to July 4th. Federal authorities have issued a secret alert to state and local law enforcement agencies, warning them of the possibility of a terrorist attack in the United States.
Not that secret if it's in the newspaper.
Just about to say, we don't keep nothing. I remember even around this time, adults, like this was, I guess, even war in the 24-hour news cycle, and then being like, why are they showing this stuff?
I
grew up in a Navy town, and there were people being like, that shouldn't be on TV. Like, what is going on?
Oh, we got a doozy of a second graph for this one. This is from the New York Times. The message from the FBI, like others issued in recent weeks, was not made public because intelligence analysts concluded that the threat was too vague to justify a public warning, the officials said. The FBI possesses no information indicating a specific and credible terrorist threat related to the July 4th Independence Day timeframe, said the message. However,
so we don't want to tell people that this is about to happen, but you didn't hear it from me, the news.
The political and cultural significance of this date warrants increased vigilance. So if we just to recap, the New York Times is reporting that the FBI didn't make this threat public because it was too vague, but there are some intelligence officials that are now talking to the New York Times for some reason. A fun time. A lot of double
secret. This reminds me of a joke I heard Danny Jolla say the other night, where he was arguing with someone about being wrong. Mm-hmm. And instead of accepting that they were wrong at the end, they were just like, well, it could be true. Sounds like. It's like, well, July 4th is still a day where something might happen. So
I got another great quote, money quote here. We're very concerned about July 4th, a senior government official said. The lack of specificity increases the concern and anxiety that is there.
Cool. Yeah, that could bomb whole planet. Whole planet a target when no one knows what target is. Think about it. If you don't know specific target, that means everybody target.
Yeah.
We got to bomb Iraq now, bro. Do it.
We can't live with this anxiety anymore. Just
we
not
can't
knowing,
live with this anxiety.
We got to know who to bomb us. That way we have to bomb them. That way we know who would be trying to bomb us.
Okay, so let's bomb whoever feels like they might be the one doing the attack. That's my plan.
Yeah.
What about you? You guys like that plan?
The alternate name for this was Prison Rules.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Whoever might be messing with you.
Right. Yeah. This is just find the toughest country in the Middle East. Right now it's Iraq.
Iraq's just eating its lunch at a table alone.
Yeah, America just shows up, knocks all the food off its plate, and goes like, I heard you're talking shit.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah. But going back to the other story, it's the doctrine of strike first or preemption. So it was like he was saying that he was going to unveil the plan in the fall. So they were talking about the fact that we were going to unveil a new preemptive action doctrine in the fall in June. So
they preemptively announced a preemptive strike doctrine to do preemptive strike.
Yeah. The doctrine holds.
Just do it. At some point, it's just like, why are you adding more? Like, you're adding more layers to this. There's too many middlemen here. Just do it. You're going to do it unilaterally anyways.
Yeah. The doctrine holds that the United States must be prepared to launch preemptive strikes against the country's dangerous new enemies, terrorist groups plotting attack against Americans, or rogue states such as Iraq that could threaten the United States or its citizens, forces, and allies abroad.
Man. Well, I hope that all works out, man.
Yeah, I think it's going to go great.
I think it'll go great.
You got to be able to launch preemptively. Otherwise,
anyone could be target.
Yeah. In lighter news, the song of the summer, it's Hot versus Me. Who will let the dogs out this year in the race to steal the summer's airwaves?
Oh, God.
There's always one breakout single.
Does that mean last year? Did last year the Baja Men come out? Was that like, who will be the next Who Let the Dogs Out?
Yeah, I think that's where they're going with this.
I love it.
Can you guess what two songs there are? They are?
Okay, it's 2002, so it's Hot and Her. And it's what, like an Eminem song, Lose Yourself. I don't know.
Without Me. This year it's shaping up to be a battle between Eminem's Without Me and Nelly's Hot and Her off Nellyville.
Yeah. Yes.
Definitely Hot and Her. Because wait, I'm trying to think what Without Me sounds like.
It feels so empty.
Without me.
Oh, now, this looks like a job for me.
So everybody, yeah.
And he's like a superhero. Mm-hmm. I remember that one.
Yeah, it's
a good song. I remember Hot and Her because I was in Australia at this point, and
it is Hot and Her.
No, but I feel like their top 40 playlist was more like a top 12 for some reason. So like any song that was popular, you would hear it 15 bajillion times. And so you would just like walk half a block and you would hear Hot and Her wafting from somewhere. It was just like
every 5 seconds, just like beat drops. I remember I can still see like the main video girl in like a knit triangle bullseye top, like her tits were just two bullseyes. And I just remember being like, I'm never gonna be this girl. Like, if this is what I have to be for boys to like me, I'm never gonna have a hot girl. I was already giving up on hot girl summer. I was like,
The late 90s and early 2000s really gave young men completely unrealistic expectations of like what
absolutely
college parties and just like parties in general were gonna be like,
just what parties were.
I was watching a bunch of old videos with a Gen Z girl, and it was so much fun watching like her perspective on like, who are these women and why are they here? Like, we should be doing something else on their own. Like, why are they just hanging out? But me also being like, wow, look at all of these very realistic bodies. Like, I miss seeing girls with like regular stomachs and bathing suits.
That's true.
Like, it was bonkers how real the bodies were back then.
Yeah. It was before every rap girl in a video became like mostly CG. Like,
yes,
basically
they would just let a regular ass girl drop it next to like a crotch rocket in like an angled up camera.
If you watch any like recent music video, like the last the video for Wet Ass Pussy by Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion, every single rap girl is actually played by Andy Serkis in a ball suit, the guy who played Gollum. He's not playing Gollum, he's playing every rap girl.
That's
no, it's just
so
like
funny.
Everyone is more airbrushed now, and back then, yeah, it was like they went to an actual club and just started taping.
Yeah, just to put a bow on the back in the day machine, I feel like the theme of all these stories was that 2002 was a year when it became very clear, I think, to most people in my generation that our institutions were like nakedly corrupt. Like, I think like there was always corruption there that was like acknowledged and assumed, but like this was the time when it was just like 6 months of news cycle where Bush was being like, yo, we can totally invade other countries if we think they have stuff that we want. That was like
right. It was a year of like actual manufacturing consent, and it's like one of the things where nowadays, you know, we live in,
you used to do under wraps, but at that time they were just like, we are manufacturing consent right now, so
yeah,
you should
right
consent.
Hi, I am the New York Times and I would like us to invade Iraq, what about you? Patriot. And so like when people now, you know, we treat this whole like you know, Trump thing is kind of this anomaly where he's like, he's calling into question the institution of the news. And it's like, yeah, everyone kind of ended up doing that after the war in Iraq, because we were like, wait, you guys really convinced us that y'all had information here that we should invade Iraq for various reasons. And it all ended up being fake. And so now everyone's like, I don't know if I trust the news. So we can't really act like, you know, oh, you know, this is just something that, you know, existed in a vacuum. Trump showed up and said, what if I make, you know, fake news a thing? So, you know, this is the beginnings of, like, I think, really public downfall of our institutions.
Institutions showing their ass for a long time.
Yeah, showing their whole ass.
Uh-huh.
So that's what was happening in the time that this episode, the pager, came out. So to get into the episode, so their pull quote is a little slow, a little late, Avon Barksdale. My own pull quote would be, I'm a Viking Holmes, Johnny Weeks. That's what Johnny says. Mm-hmm. I feel so bad for
horribly yellowed teeth. They did a great job with, like, yes. I could not look at a Mother Mary.
Yeah. My choice for pull quote was, I don't want to go to no dance unless I can rub some tit from
Lester. That was mine. Yeah. I wrote that down. Oh my gosh.
I mean, I think
that sounds like something I would accidentally hear my grandpa say, and then he would turn around and see me and go, don't repeat that.
It's a great, great quote. Love me some Lester Freeman. So this episode, like you said, Vince, it's about a lot of things. What are our general thoughts on this episode? Vince, did you like this?
So my thoughts on this episode were, for a while when I was watching this episode, I was like, this is a very cautionary tale ass episode. You know, you got the extended sequence of Avon taking D to see his dad that is in a coma. And then you got Bubbles going to see Johnny Weeks, who's got the bug now. It felt very traditional.
He's got the bug and he's pissing in a bag.
Yeah, it was very traditional sort of homicide / Law and Order, like, don't do drugs or this stuff will happen to you. So there was a little bit of that corny episode, but then you get a lot of Omar. I think this is where, like, Omar cemented himself as, like, this new kind of character that everybody was just super excited, or at least I was. Everybody that watches this, yeah, I think for the first time is like, oh my god, I fucking love Omar. And so I think you end up remembering the Omar stuff a lot more than you do the kind of slightly corny, maybe cautionary tale stuff. So it's in a sense it's doing what The Wire always does, which is, you know, it gives you the tropey stuff that the tropey hooky stuff that brings everyone in, and then gives you, like, a little bit of new stuff, a little bit of old, a little bit of new.
Yeah, I agree. Katrina, did you like this episode?
Yeah, I liked it. I do. I totally see what you're saying, Vince, about the corny, like, the parts that could be more like after school, especially looking back. But yeah, I did love a lot about how it shows Omar in this episode. I love that it shows him and old boy kissing. I think this might have been one of the first times I've saw men kiss like this in this kind of, like, way, men that were portrayed this way. Like, I'm pretty sure this is the first time I saw, like, two men that weren't already written as, like, ultra feminine,
right,
be tender towards each other.
Yeah,
so I saw them kiss and was like, oh my god, I remember seeing this and kind of being like, wait a minute, what? Like,
yeah,
I've never seen this happen before. And just to have someone so scary be so loving at the same time, like,
yeah
I like Omar, this, and I ended up rooting for, and I guess I probably go back and forth, especially as you get further into the series, but I was, like, rooting for them to not trace their pagers. Like, I really wanted them to the cops to just leave them alone and let them handle their business at one point. And I was like, I probably shouldn't be thinking that, but I kind of was.
Yeah. There's this, like, tension where it's like, who is going to who's going to get the Barksdales first? Is it going to be Omar or is it going to be the cops? And yeah, after a while, you're like, I really think the cops should just wrap it up and go home and let Omar take care of this.
Yeah,
he's got a much more interesting story than a bunch of, like, drunken Irish horny cops who are just like, how are we going to stop the crime? You know,
what if I fall down the stairs?
Yeah. I did write at one point, is this sponsored by Jameson? Because
it might have been.
Everyone is honestly drinking Jameson.
Yeah.
Yes. So I like this episode. But I will say, I was talking to some people recently. Francesca and I were meeting up with some people who, you know, they're into, like, politics and stuff. And they're very political people, and they said that they tried watching The Wire a few different times, and they couldn't get into it because they had no idea what was going on, and it felt like homework. and whatnot. And I will say that this for with this episode, there was a little bit of me that's like, I get it. I understand people who watch the show and feel like lost, because this has got to be the most of all of the episodes we've seen so far. This is the most like throw you into the deep end and just let you figure it out for yourself. Like this, I feel like this show does not hold your hand.
Yeah, there's a lot of remembering stuff.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I never would have thought about that, but you're right.
It's like, because like in this episode, the show spends almost like zero time like telling you who people are, like what their names are and who they're with and why they are important. And it really requires you to like remember a lot of hanging threads. Like in this episode, we find out that this guy, John Bailey, gets killed. And John Bailey, I have no idea who he is.
Yeah.
They mention his death in passing. And then it's like, oh, John Bailey is the third guy in Omar's crew, the one who's not gay. I didn't know his name was John. I didn't know his name was Bailey. Like, it just was.
That guy does not look like a John Bailey in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't look like a John Bailey. And also, it's just like they barely mention his death. You find out he died because Stringer and Avon are like sitting in a room. Stinkum is getting like his own corner. He's getting a raise, a promotion.
Which
and then,
just to be so hood to casually get used to saying the name Stinkums. Just two terrifying men
two
repeatedly
grown men.
Saying Stinkums. No yeah. one's cracking a smile. His name's
so
Stinkums. That's so silly.
It's so silly. It is. It's a very funny name for a very serious guy.
Yes.
And like while he's getting like this promotion, I think like Stringer gets like a page or a call or something and is like basically says like we got one of Omar's guys. I feel like in order to like really follow all of the threads, like I've had to rewatch the show multiple times and it's almost like a fantasy novel more than it is a like a cop show. It's like in the way that like people who are super into Lord of the Rings are like, oh well, so the Undying Lands is Valinor, right? So all elves come from Valinor, right? And so like if
like
you
there's
are
a in... language to it,
right? Yeah. Exactly. It's like there's so much world building that's done and they don't hold your hand at all.
And I do feel like it's similar to those kind of the like films in a way that like you're learning all of that through these conversations that
yes.
are just like, oh, I'm just supposed to listen to this whole conversation
because
it's exposition.
Exactly.
Like when they keep messing up that guy's name, Leggett, and
Leggett,
that becomes
yes.
like a long, I'm like, okay, so those two people are
yes.
relevant. But then later, you have to do all of that on your own. Like,
yes.
I felt like I was eavesdropping and being like, oh, okay, got it.
Yes. Yeah, that's that. Honestly, that's true. If you are watching the show for the first time, and I think I remember this with myself, there were a lot of scenes that were basically like, you know, in Charlie Brown when the teacher is talking and it's just,
oh, good grief.
Like, because you're like, I don't know what the fuck they're talking about. And at some point, my attention span is such that I just glaze over and I assume, well, what they're talking about can't be that important. It's they're at a desk. Like, and there's not any music cues to tell you should be paying attention. So
I mean, they did that in the episode, I can't remember if it was one or two, where they had like the black and white flashback to who the security guard was.
Yeah,
and
that was the only time.
It was very obvious, like HBO made them do this and they didn't
yes.
want to, and it's kind of sucked. And so they were like, we're not doing that anymore.
And they stopped doing it completely to the point at which like we, first of all, I was going to say, the Leggett guy, he is a death that we never see and we only hear about in the pilot when I think McNulty is talking to Judge Phelan and is just like basically saying, here are some names of people who are connected, are deaths that came directly from the Barksdale crew. I'm telling you, this guy is bad. And the fact that they like repeat this name later on as if you're supposed to know who the fuck Leggett is crazy. But when you watch it more than once, after a while you start seeing that every scene It matters. Every part matters.
All the pieces matter.
Not only that, you find new connections. Like
new ones,
there's a
yes.
scene where Poot is talking about some chick he's trying to bang, and
yes.
and her name is Arletta Muzzone. And I'm like, oh shit, is that
Muzzone?
Brother Muzzone, the
is that a relation to
yeah,
Brother
the black
Muzzone?
Muslim muscle that
yeah,
Omar hires. I don't know what. Two seasons, next season, later
next
this season,
maybe.
Yeah,
there's a lot of lore in this. But the funny thing about it is, like, with Lord of the Rings, knowing this information about like who created the ring or whatever, or these, you know, who Morgoth is, is like cool to know because you know what powers they have. Nobody has powers in this, so you're like, well, why would I care what anyone's name is?
And like, they're like, you'll know later, don't worry.
Yeah,
yeah, right. Yeah.
And, well, I do feel like as yeah. far as, and I didn't think about this before, but you saying that, Vince, made me realize, like, there is a thing in Baltimore where people are connected like that in these weird ways where, like, my parents grew up in Baltimore, like, I don't know, 10 to 15 minutes away from each other. They never went to the same schools, but they know all of the same kids.
Damn.
Like, they'll talk about whole families and be like, wait, did you know him? And they'll be like, no, but I knew her sister. And there were five of them all together. And like, they break down and they'll be like my parents just did this when I was home. And my dad's like, yeah, Luke dated her older sister. And that's like one of his best friends that he just went fishing with. It's like all of these. So it will kind of be that kind of thing where I don't know if someone was just like putting in Baltimore-isms where
right.
you really are like low key connected to people like that.
Yeah.
If you stay
it is
in
a
the
small
city your whole life.
It feels like a small town, which is, I think, also what makes it interesting is like, rather than having this like giant expansive city feeling where it's like you really can get lost, I think, in like shows that take place in other cities, Baltimore starts to feel like a small town.
Yes.
In the way that everyone, you know, at one point when Carve is talking to he's like interrogating Bodie, and he talks about like the East Side Project that he, you know,
yes.
comes from, and Bodie knows it, and
yes.
you know, it's like, yeah, it feels like in
that's
a way
absolutely the kind of thing that you could be like, oh, I dated so and so, and you'd be like, wait, that lived on here and here, and
yeah,
that's
right.
like whatever house, yeah, that kind
yeah.
of thing.
I Bill love
Hart
that.
Anthony's sister with the club foot.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Everyone knows each other, and the details of this are so specific, and they don't necessarily, for me, it doesn't get in the way of enjoying the show when I didn't know who they were talking about. But I do understand for some people.
Hello. Speaking of getting in the way of enjoying the show, Matt, we have to stop for some ads.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I mean, oh, yes.
Oh, hell yeah.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen and everyone else. Before we continue, first, we must hear a word from our sponsors who I don't know who they are yet, but we'll find out.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay, we're back. All right, guys, back to talking about The Wire. So I've split this episode into three different parts. There's Omar coming, D'Angelo hates his job, and finally, a show about wires. So those are our three things. I say we start with the Omar storyline, because Omar, I think, is everyone's favorite character. He's beautiful.
He's the
gay.
Best.
He's
His
very violent.
Are beautiful.
I mean, they set up.
He doesn't
yeah.
swear.
In the last episode, they set up this whole thing that Omar is going to team up with with our ragtag team of outsider cops that we've come to know and love. And they sort of set up this whole thing like they're going to join forces, and that would be like the fan service thing to do. And then they show up and you realize that like the cops are kind of too stupid and Omar's too smart for them to catch him up in something.
Completely.
So yeah, so they like they go like they're going to arrest him, but he's like, nah, you guys aren't going to do that. But I do have some information, and he just tosses off, you know, like a couple nuggets of information that they've been seeking this whole time. And he somehow knows that they're trying to find out.
Yeah, their whole plan was follow Omar and at some point arrest him with a gun because he will have a gun.
Right. They and sat all day just hoping he was going to have a gun when they
They sat all day, I think multiple days, waiting for him to come out with a gun. And so they could pull him over, find the gun, and then flip him and coerce him into being a CI for their case against the Barksdales.
Instead, he has leverage on them because first he gives them the crumb. He's like, oh, I know who killed the citizen.
Yes.
So he gives them that. And then he like drops that he knows that Bubbles is their informant. So they can't fuck him over because he can tell the Barksdale crew who their snitch is. So they can't do anything to him now.
You know, I used to work the homes back when your brother was up there. You get a chance, let him know they blew up John Bailey last night.
Good man. A lot of enemies.
Mm-hmm.
Saying, you trying to catch up with Bird? Word is he dropped a working man.
Hey, wait. Hold up. Come on, don't play me. What working man? What Bird?
Come on, now ain't but one working man now, is there? Bird? I think your snitch can handle that. Shit, Bubbles no Bird.
That's such an amazing scene because I think going back to what you were saying, Vince, about like I think it was in the pilot when they did that flashback to seeing who Willie Gantt was. He's the guy in the courtroom who said, him, sir, he is the bad man. And then you see him dead. Yeah. In this, they don't even say his name. He just says, Herb Bird got a working man. And McNulty is like, wait, who are you talking about? And he goes, there ain't but one working man. They won't even give you his name now.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. It's like, yes, Willie Gantt.
You're supposed to know.
Like you're supposed to know. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to know that Willie Gantt is the working man, the one who snitched in the courtroom, in the pilot. He is the one who D'Angelo, when he was like locked up for a second, they try to get him to write a apology note to him, hoping that he would incriminate himself. And they mentioned that, you know, hey, this was a civilian. He wasn't in the game. He was a working man. You're supposed to remember that.
Yeah.
and understand who they are talking about. And I think, you know, I give audiences some credit. I think most people knew who the working man was. But I love that they completely abandoned. Like, they probably said to HBO, no, fuck off. We're not doing that.
Yeah.
We're not doing a flashback. I'm done.
I feel like
And it's like a more extreme version of this, but there's a old like noir detective movie called Brick that Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and the whole thing, they're speaking a totally different language. And you playing that scene felt a little bit like I was in that movie for a second, because everyone has these code names based on what they're into. It's like, oh, the songbird, da 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 da. Like everyone has these different things. And that's when he was talking, I was doing the same thing, like, well, who the hell is the working man? And being like, okay, again, why is he speaking? But that is also, Omar would speak in riddles.
Right,
like,
yes.
He would like limerick the cops.
Only that, it's like,
answer me these questions three.
Yes.
Yeah. And not only that, it's like, this is sort of a microcosm of why I end up, you know, loving the show and going back to it. Is it like, it sets you up for some kind of fan service that they would do on every show where it's like,
yes,
all your faves are going to team up, and then it pulls the rug out from under you where at the last second it's like, no, that's stupid. Omar's way too smart and the cops are way too stupid for that. But then it does give you like this other form of fan service that ends up being way better, which is like, it gives you Omar as this guy who just knows everything. And could never get, caught, like could never get caught and, you know, played by the cops in that way. And instead he's going to do the reverse and play them, which is
right.
Great.
Yeah. Much more fun to watch and just like more real and interesting than, you know, watching the, oh, they're going to create some sort of Justice League in which Omar and the cops are...
Yeah, the cool criminals and the cool cops team up to take out the bad criminals.
And later in the season, you know, they you think you see a version of that, but then when you realize that Omar is still going to continue doing his profession of choice, you realize, like, oh, this is a really flawed partnership that works mostly in favor of Omar, and that's what makes it 1,000 times better. But yeah, so the other things happening in this particular Omar storyline is before the parlay, you're watching Omar like design some trap. You're seeing how they like how they stick up drug dealers, and it's him and Bailey and Brandon. His lover, who are all together.
The Omar, Brandon, and Bailey circus.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And they're on the east side, and, you know, they're basically planning out how they're going to trick some young hoppers into a corner and then stealing their money and drugs.
That'd be the trap right there, Holmes.
You figure they roll through the alley for sure.
Man, rats always run the holes in time of danger.
Hey, you him, ain't you?
Who?
Danger.
There's something so cute about all of the interactions between Brandon and Omar. Because, like, Brandon is clearly, I don't know, just, he's enamored with Omar. You know, he's just like, Omar is just so cool. Like, it reminds me of that movie True Romance, where it's like Patricia Arquette's main thing is just, you're so cool. that's what it feels like. I just, it's
he's
very
so
cute.
Naive and like he, okay. And this is again, an extreme version, but he reminds me a little bit of in, this is a very new reference, but this Fool Chris Estrada show, when they pick up the little boy that thinks that they're in West Side Story the whole time instead of actually going to fight in a real gang. That's kind of what Brandon feels like. He thinks it's pretend. Like he knows it's not pretend, but he's like, we've got guns and I'm with my boyfriend and this is so cool and sexy.
Yes, 100%. 100%. Because it is
they do show him playing a pinball later. We're like,
right.
Yeah, he's literally doing so video games.
Yeah, he's out in public after having just ripped off the biggest fucking drug dealers on the west side of Baltimore.
Exactly.
He's out in public just like being the king of pinball. Like I remember when I first watched it thinking like, oh, they're going to get the wrong guy. Maybe that's not him. That was the thought I had. But then when it ends up, no, that's him. You're just like, fuck, this kid is naive, man.
He's that dumb. It's like, go to the Inner Harbor, idiot. What's wrong with you? Like, go a couple blocks before you go celebrating.
But even it shows that even Omar is not above, you know, thinking with his dick in terms of hiring competent people around him. You know, he's pulling the whole, you know, hire the hot chick as your secretary, even though she can't use Excel.
And they have one more cute scene together that I love, in which they're talking about the fact that Bailey, who is the third guy in their crew, is missing.
Ain't like him to be late.
Bailey, you fucking dope fiend. I'm telling you, them fucking people ain't to be relied on.
Yo, why you always gotta talk like that, man?
What?
F this and F that. Don't nobody want to hear them dirty words, man. Especially coming from such a beautiful mouth.
I love that he just swear.
There's a gay stick-up guy who has like the morals of a Victorian era like grandmother.
Exactly. That he's like, yes, I literally blow holes in people with a double barrel shotgun, but also etiquette. Like, have some decorum.
Dick can't get hard to sodomize you when you use the Lord's name in vain like that.
He's like, don't nobody want to hear those dirty words coming out such a beautiful mouth. And it's like, no, that's just you. This is a very you thing. It's like, I don't think anyone else would notice.
Makes me go soft.
Yeah. But it's a very sweet scene, and you really got to give a shout out to Michael K. Williams for this character, because like, it wasn't just that he was gay. It was that he went for it. Like when they make out, it's like, whoa.
Yeah. Like he likes him. Like, yeah.
I remember thinking like, oh, the actor must be gay.
Yeah. Well, because when Pulp Fiction came out, like there was a thing where Quentin Tarantino was like, yeah, I had trouble finding like a good black actor who would be willing to, get pretend raped in the scene and that in the ball gag scene. Yeah. Uh-huh. And so like, that's kind of in your head when this came out. Michael K. Williams is like, no, dude, I'll fucking do it. Don't worry about it.
And not just do it, but like really, really do it. Like really go for it. Like
like you said, when you said, Vince, that he hired the hot girl, I like, not that I disagree, but I feel like he likes him more than that. I feel like he might love Brandon. Like,
sure.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
But Brandon's also still a slightly incompetent stick up boy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
He's definitely not as discreet as Omar, but he does love him. And you can see that in the like, I mean, he kissed the shit out of him, and it's really like a hot kiss, you know? I'm into it.
Should we leave, Matt?
Could you guys leave real quick?
Here's the thing. Matt didn't clip that up for the podcast. He already had it clipped up from before. Yeah, no.
This is ringtone. I'm not even recording now. I just want to show you my favorite weird boners I get.
Another podcast, Matt's Weird Boners.
That's
called the Fraudcast.
It's called the Fraudcast, and you can get it on patreon.com/fraudcast. So then, of course, as we said, Kima and McNulty follow Brandon and Omar, and then they have that parlay. While they are doing that stakeout of Omar, one of my like favorite parts of this stakeout is that McNulty is with Kima and asks to borrow her phone, and then has a scene where he calls his ex-wife and argues about the kids. Like he has two boys that he wants to sleep over at his new divorced dad pad. And they're having this argument in which basically you can't hear his ex-wife on the other end of the line, but the summation of the argument is, I don't believe you actually have a bed for these kids to sleep in. And he's like, yeah, I do. I have a bed. And he doesn't. He is lying. He leaves immediately after the scene with Kima and goes to IKEA and then builds some bunk beds in.
Well, he fails to build them.
He tries to build them, and he's
this
very.
This scene was the most
drunk.
Unbelievable of the entire episode to me. Like there's drugs, there are strippers, there's a lot of things going on, and I
was
like,
"Gay stick-up boys."
He did not build this bed that drunk in lighting this dim. It didn't happen.
Oh, wait, didn't he fail? Like he never.
No,
built
no, no.
It. They cut to it being done.
Yeah, they cut to it being done.
He dumps it all out messily, like is barely looking at the direction. I'm like, yeah, the screws are already all over the floor. Like you started this so
haphazardly. You gotta find the fucking Allen wrench, man. You're never gonna get those.
He didn't line up the letter boards in the same piles so he can.
I love that at one point. So he's drinking. He's just drinking that fifth of Jameson.
Yes.
He's singing. He's singing
Bottle,
some.
Label out Jameson.
Yeah. Okay. Label out Jameson. He's singing some Irish ditty about whatever the fuck. And he like has the Allen wrench in one hand. He drops it. And then he takes that as a cue to drink more. So he just gets just continually drunk during that scene. I love it. I love it because it is, you know, that's like, it's a metaphor for the show. It's like building IKEA furniture drunk is difficult, but if you're McNulty, you'll do it. All the pieces matter. You'll figure it out. You just got
to
connect all the dots.
Exactly. That's how they bring up murders that you haven't seen. Yes. It's just all the different pieces of the IKEA furniture. And it's like,
honestly,
you'll figure it out.
This show is the IKEA instruction manual of TV shows. It's like, you kind of get what they're saying, but there's a lot of having to look at the box and going,
a lot of it is just you as that little stick figure going, with a question mark over your head.
Oh, it's so true. And yes, at the very end of this, McNulty actually doesn't get his kids. I guess his kids, his wife keeps them away, and he just sulks on
the
bed. Yeah,
they're all just like gone or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, he was supposed to get the kids for that weekend, and I guess his wife said, I still do not believe that you will have a bed. And he also calls his wife a cunt in the most roundabout way.
We have a segment that we like to call David Simon's Guide to Fancy Curse Words for English Majors.
Oh.
And I think that this scene is a perfect nominee slash exemplar of this segment.
Color? What the fuck do you care what color they are? Hello? You would think a less enlightened man than myself, cruder man than myself, a man less sensitized to the qualities and charms and value of women. A man like that, not me, but a man like that, he just might call her a cunt.
You just called the mother of your children a cunt.
No, I did not call her that.
Yes, you fucking did.
No, I did not. Let's just leave this guy. I got some stuff to do.
Just, he leaves the car going, all right, I got to build this fucking bunk bed for my cunt ass kids. Oh, so great. I just, yeah, you know, I gotta,
feel like that's like, you know, if a bro version of how Amy Sherman Palladino writes. Like, you know what I mean? It was, yes, like you said, it was so roundabout, but then ends in cunt still. Like,
yes, yes.
Yeah, it's 100%. The writer like giving him elaborate permission to call a woman a cunt, and he's like, yes, doing it, yeah, through his characters.
Yeah, I love that. He totally does do the like the satire rule. It's like, no, he can say that because it's not him. He's saying he would say that if he were that character.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah,
kitschy.
So, yeah, exactly.
He called her a cunt with a K. It's like lighter. It's a little bit cuter. It's not quite as harsh.
It's fun.
Nobody, yeah, ever thinks this is funny but me, but I did have a guy once threatened to set me on fire. And I said, you threatened to set me on fire the other day. And he said, I didn't say I was going to set you on fire. I said I should have. And tried to like
important distinction
die, yeah, on that, yeah, hill. Yeah.
No, I should have when I had the chance.
Yes.
You know that time you were covered in gasoline that time?
I didn't because I'm so good.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. That actually makes me a good person because I didn't do something that anybody would have done. Everybody wants to set you on fire. He sounds like a nice guy. Moving on, now we're in the storyline. D'Angelo hates his job. So in the storyline, D'Angelo is trying to recover his pride after the pit got robbed, but also he seems to be growing more and more disillusioned with his life as a gangster. And we start off with they're back at the pit, and you know, we talked about the scene where Michael B. Jordan is sitting around playing with like an action figure, and Bodie and Poot are having a conversation about how whether or not one can get AIDS through getting, yeah, your dick sucked.
Which, I think that's why this episode comes off as cautionary tale-ish, because there's like a lot of AIDS talk and
a lot,
like,
of bug talk. You're,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, that was the ultimate cautionary tale, like throughout the entire 90s.
Yes.
Yes. So,
yeah.
And you have to remember, like, 2002 Baltimore is still the 90s. You, yeah, know, like, yeah, there's still, it's
just look
not
at Rhonda,
like,
Perlman's hair.
Yeah, exactly. Just look at everyone's hair in the show. I mean, everyone is, there's actually a great character. If we're doing our segment Public Hair,
mm-hmm,
this is the segment in which we find someone in the episode, whether a main character or a side character, who has the most real ass fucking bureaucrat looking hair. And it is in the scene where Judge Phelan comes in to sign the affidavit for the pager. There's this, like, you see Rhonda and Kima and McNulty, but you also, there's a blonde woman. She has one line and it's something like, the second copy goes to the police. And
the
she,
blonde lady with the glasses?
Yes, the blonde, yes, lady with the glasses.
I knew who you were gonna, like, I knew who you were gonna say before you even contextualize it, because it's like you could not notice that.
It's, yes, amazing. It's like another example of like, is this not an actor? Is this a real person? Because I don't know how you get someone who looks so much like they are the fucking shift manager of the TSA, and
yeah.
they went to a Supercuts and tried to get the Rachel. Like, the shit looks.
Yes. I was
like,
noticing that too. Just 90s stuff, like the lip liner, the dark liner. Like, there were some things, like everyone dressing in like sexy business lady doing business outfits. Like,
right.
Everyone looked like
but
my
from
mom.
10 years ago.
Yes. Like, yeah. When ladies used to wear sneakers with suits, and I was just like, let's go.
Oh, I loved it. I was so impressed with, again, they just find the perfect casting for people who look like they, you know, took a wrong turn at their job at the DMV and were like, oh, you guys are casting for a part in The Wire? I'll do it.
Yeah. Which they really did sometimes, not those roles, but like my cousins definitely got paid as extras at The Wire. Like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that it was a thing they definitely did I think in a lot, not just in the scenes in the PJs, but also I think there's a few actual non-actors who play policemen or like people who are just, they look too real to you're like, this is not an actor, this is someone who actually does this job.
And to show you how real time this is, the reason some of my people in my family did it is because it paid $5 more than being a real lookout. So
hey. But yeah, I mean,
trivia by the way, that conversation about HIV AIDS transmission is taken almost verbatim from the nonfiction book The Corner, A Year in the Life of an Inner City Neighborhood by David Simon and former homicide detective Ed Burns.
You're saying you can't catch the bug just by getting your dick sucked. Dumbass, you gotta be in some pussy to get it, all right? Man, wear it cool if you want. Right, but don't nobody like sucking on rubber.
How would you know?
I mean, I remember, I think I literally had that conversation on the schoolyard when in elementary school in the 90s where we all learned, like, you can't get AIDS from, you know, shaking someone's hand, and you can't get it from kissing, and you can't get it from getting your dick sucked. And I remember thinking, like, that's pretty much all you, that's great news, because if I had it at that time, if I had had AIDS, I'd be like, oh, all I have to do, I just get my dick sucked all the time. Sounds like heaven, bro, because I'd never had any of it. So, Bodhi says, no one likes the taste of rubber. And then D clowns him and he says, how would you know? And that's the point at which Bodhi decides to just throw a 40 at the wall against just to like.
Instead of saying your mom told me, which would have been the obvious response.
Yeah, but yeah, he should have said your mom told me, or, you know, attempted a D's nuts joke. But instead, he decides to punk Wallace. And it's in that moment where it's like you can kind of tell that Bodhi is, he's still trying to establish dominance. And he was doing, like you were saying, with the domino effect, where it's like the pecking order, where he's just like, he knows he knows that D likes him. D looks at Wallace as like a young, innocent kid who's yet to be spoiled by the game. And Bodhi, I think, wants to ruin that for him a little. So he starts to fuck with him, which that's what Bodhi's like.
And then Wallace makes that very childlike scream when the bottle breaks over him, which is sort of heartbreaking.
I know, it's so sad. It's really cute. But don't worry, Bodhi gets his during the storyline, because this is the storyline. This is the episode where Bodhi is finally caught by Herc and Carve, who, after Bodhi escaped from Boy's Village and went directly back to the pit where he works, the obvious place he would go, Herc and Carve spend the last episode just going to they go over to like Bodhi's mom's house, and they're just like, they're too stupid to know where exactly Bodhi would be. And they finally catch up to him at the pit.
At the place where he always is.
The place where he be.
It's always the last place you look.
Yeah, exactly. And then
his hangout is literally like a couch in the middle of a quad somewhere.
Yeah,
like,
in an open field.
Yeah.
He's nothing
but.
That
couch was in Baltimore for a really long time, too.
Yes. Actually, the funny thing is, I forget who said this, but initially for the pilot, it was a real couch that was just there in Baltimore, and they used it. And then someone between filming, I think the city just took the couch because they're like, you can't have a ratty couch sitting in the middle of this field. And so they had to, the set people had to build an exact replica of the shitty couch to use for the rest of the series, which I love that. I love that they were going to spend thousands of dollars to make a shitty projects couch because they forgot that, you know, things like that happen. You know, the city will condemn stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Carve and Herc, they get Bodhi and they put him into an interrogation room and they decide, hey, let's do good cop, bad cop. And this is probably one of the
all-time, one of the all-time great Wire comedy sequences.
I do like this.
It's so great because, like, Carve is trying so hard. You know what? I'm really impressed with his acting in this because he's playing a cop who is, he's acting at acting, you know what I mean? He does such a great job of pretending to be bad at a cop who's trying to be nice.
Yeah,
it's like it's very
so
meta.
Uncomfortable. Like just why? Like and you watch him, and it's like, yes, this is how like a dumb guy who thinks he's smarter than the other person would attempt to do like pickup artist rules on somebody.
Yes, yes. Where he's just he shows up and he's like bracelet too tight. Like he's like trying.
Yeah. The second he did that, I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, are you gonna act like this is this guy's first time being arrested?
Right?
Even.
Yes. Oh, it's so good. I have a clip.
Bracelet too tight. Cop, you banged. It's Herc's uncle. Herc went off the leash on this one.
And, I suppose you at the other end of that leash, huh?
I know about coming up hard and all.
But you came up hard?
Flaghouse Projects. East Side. You know, you remind me of me. I'm thinking we should work something out.
What do I get?
What you want?
I want for you to suck my dick.
You're supposed to be the good cop,
dumb motherfucker.
It's great because, like, you know, like you said, Carver doing such a good job in that scene, but I also think Bodhi does a really good job in that scene.
Yes,
because you can tell that he doesn't buy this for a single second, and you're waiting for the other shoe to drop that whole time. Like, what is he gonna say that burst the mystique here?
That's how I felt. I was like, oh man, what is he good? The second they got really close, I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's so perfect because it's like the way that Carve is being fake is such like a recognizable fakeness. Like we've all had that, like the guy who comes to your school for the assembly to tell us about how he grew up hard,
like he did everything but sit backwards. Like,
yes, exactly. Exactly, he didn't like sit backwards on the chair and go, let me rap with you real quick. It is like it's just the tone of like condescension is so perfect, and you can tell that Bodhi immediately he sees right through it, and so it just makes the punchline all the better. And then of course him just saying you're supposed to be the good cop
was
dumb motherfucker. So good.
And then you could make a drinking game of watching The Wire and just having the subtle racist epithets that get popped in every once in a while.
Like, you mean when Bodhi is eating the sub, or do you mean when which one?
Oh, what's the one when he's eating the sub? Because I was talking about the one you just played when he calls him a monkey.
Yeah. Yes.
Then,
yes.
What's his face when he? Like we'll probably talk about it later.
There's
when
a Chinese-owned sandwich place. I'm guessing is what they're talking about, which has never
What's
been referenced.
What's the sandwich
before.
One?
This sub be chink ass Bob's Bob. Of course, you might be all that when it comes to thumping on niggas, but I can't do shit with that stick, man. Oh, you do better.
Oh, I got you. I think I did miss that one because I had my note during that scene was these cops could run a boys' home if they weren't so abusive.
Yeah.
they almost kind of like relate to him and like get along. Like they're vibing for a second.
They are.
I think that's the main qualification for running a boys' home, sadly, is
to be abusive.
Yes. Yeah. I know. Unfortunately, you're right. But
yeah,
like,
but they do have a nice moment. And you know, it is sad if unfortunately they are too abusive. But yeah, no, the other racial epithet you're talking about is Presbyluski when he cracks the code, the epithet yo's, which they say a lot.
Which I have heard that before in just like actual people using that. And so it was just so, his whole point in that scene is just like, I told you we were smarter than them. Like he's just so elated that like for a second he doubted that he possibly, that these like kids selling drugs could have possibly been smart at all. He's like, right. You don't have to fucking know nothing. It's the best. Like,
yeah. Like me. Just in terms of that scene, I do have to say one of the funniest things about Presbyluski cracking the code is that he, in mentioning how he cracked the code, he goes, well, I really like word search puzzles.
I like word search puzzles, you know, where you gotta find the hidden words. So I thought I could do the same thing with the numbers. If it was a code that involved math or algebra or whatever, these little yo's in the projects wouldn't be able to follow along. But with this, all you gotta do is jump the 5 button. Ain't no math to it, it's just how the phone looks when you look at it.
Prez, you little genius.
Jesus!
I could kill you, that's so good.
I've never heard of an adult doing a word search.
Yeah.
Like, I've heard of adults playing crossword puzzles, mm-hmm. but like a word search is something you play when you're at the kids' menu.
It's like the bumper bowling of like newspaper games.
Yeah.
I feel like that was, I guess, was he supposed to be like, I'm a wholesome nerd that's okay with getting mouth kissed? Like, why did they do that?
I mean, I think it's because it's like he's kind of a dumbass, but
okay.
Yeah.
No, they're pointing out that he's a dummy and that he might just be the perfect type of dummy to crack a code that is meant for children, for young drug dealers.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, that is like, supposed to be, I mean, it's played as if it's like, wow, he's so smart. I mean, McNulty calls him a genius.
Yes.
But it
and
is.
And kisses him like he's Scarlett O'Hara.
Yeah. Yes. But it is also, if you, you know, if you take kind of like, I don't know, a more broad view, it's an insane, it's a funny scene in which you're like, wait, but this guy, number one, that's a code that is for kids, so it's not that impressive that he cracked it. And also, like, didn't he just blind a 14-year-old kid? Isn't he a piece of shit?
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, you cracked a code. You are fully redeemed. Like,
yeah, but even, oh, and you saying that, it's like, oh, I blind people, but I also love circling things with pencils. Like, that's just giving him another facet.
Yes, I love that. And I think it's, to me, it's intentional because it's supposed to, I mean, these are multifaceted characters. It's not, no one is purely evil or purely good. So it's not that we're supposed to think of Presbyluski only as, like, the worst moments that he has on the show, but at the same time I do think it says a lot that like how easily he is forgiven even by quote-unquote good cops like McNulty,
right?
If it helps with his case, you know.
Oh yeah,
I think it says something.
I mean, they're definitely setting him up at, like, it traditionally, like, Herc would be the guy who blinded someone because he's like the
right,
he's like obviously like a big bully.
Oh, yes.
But like this show's kind of, I think it's taking pains to point out that Presbo is like the classic sissy with a gun who's actually going to do more damage because he's the one that's trying to prove himself to all the other tough guys around him.
Yeah.
And is also
right.
like
that
more scared and more insecure about his own position.
Right. Yeah. That's super fair.
But to continue wrapping up D's storyline, the centerpiece scene for D is the scene in which he and his girlfriend go to a fancy restaurant and he asks for a better table and he's denied, and his girlfriend mentions that he should have pushed more, which if I'm going to be honest, is every relationship I've ever had. I do not like being confrontational at restaurants. I will not ask for the, if I get the wrong order, I will eat the order. Francesca does not like this about me, but I have a lot of trouble asking people in the service industry to do the things that I want them to do.
That's dumb, Matt. That's dumb. I'm with Francesca.
I know. Most people are. I just can't.
I was about to say, Matt, that's kind of extreme.
I know. No, I am a true bitch.
Like, trying to get the right order is not the same thing as sending a soup exactly. back at the Museum of Tolerance, exactly. for the record.
I know it's not, but you have to understand, I was so... just traumatized by my dad always being a pain in the ass at restaurants that like I'm like actively chosen the opposite, and it's done nothing but hurt me, to be honest.
So you don't complain the way I tip too much.
Oh no, like, I tip. I also tip too much.
I tip for like every black person. Oh. That like I'm basically just fighting a stereotype with every tip.
Yes. No, same. Yeah, 100%.
I get it.
I do that as well. I always tip too much because
I will go to dinner with my white friends and be like, is this too much? And they're like, Jesus, yes. And I'm like, okay, good. And that's where I leave it.
But Dee in the scene is getting clearly uncomfortable with being in a restaurant, not just like surrounded by like white people, but it's like he's rich uncomfortable people. With being with rich people who are not, they're not in the game, they're not in his world, and he's just worried about like, do you think they know, which is like something that I don't know, I used to in college help my friends who were trying acid for the first time. Like we would go around and I would help Sherpa them because I really liked acid, and a few times we would be in the middle of public and I would see this look on their face. And I would just go up to them and put my arm around them and I go, nobody knows.
Yeah.
Nobody knows. Because it's so freeing.
Oh my God.
It's so freeing.
So real, Matt, as far as tripping.
Yes. When you realize, like, nobody knows a thing, they would never suspect that you're on acid right now. There's not, at worst, they'd be like, oh, he's high on weed. So, in that same way, I feel like Dee's girlfriend is trying to be like, nobody cares about your story.
Do they know what?
You know what I'm about.
So? Your money good, right? D, we the only black people in here?
It ain't about that. It ain't what I'm talking about. It's about where we... I'm just saying, you know, I feel like some shit just stay with you. You know what I'm saying?
Can I interest you in dessert?
Yes, thank you.
I'll bring the cart.
Boy, nobody give a damn about you and your story. You got money, you get to be whatever you say you are. That's the way it is.
Oh, sir, I'm sorry. These are the samples.
She comes from, I think, a perspective that I think is like unfortunate because it is actually wrong.
Yes!
Because
I was like, the whole time she was talking, I was like, but she's wrong.
She's wrong. Her perspective is that, listen, if you have money, then everything, then you can be whoever you want to be.
She's basically a walking Scarface poster.
Yeah.
And what all these black men would emulate is like, these are the rules. I get it. I've seen it on TV. This is the way it works.
Yes. First you get the money, then you get the power.
Unlike Matt, she has never heard Stephen Jenkins of Third Eye Blind clown Beyonce for taking A1 to a steakhouse.
Whereas I have, and I would never do that.
It's very clear. Like there, again, it was the same in last episode when Bodhi is at the boys' home and he freaks out because not everyone's from his tiny neighborhood. Like their whole thing is that they're extremely provincial and they're not really comfortable. Like their whole value to their job is like knowing their tiny neighborhood really well. But like outside of that, they're kind of lost. And he's sort of like. You know, just the sequence where he takes the cake off the he's trying to do a double flex where he knows what his girlfriend wants, so he's gonna like grab it and take it from her. And then when the guy's like, oh no, that's just the sample, like he feels completely shamed and
And
this
it comes
was all heartbreaking for me. Like he's trying so hard and just striking out at every turn.
And it comes right after the moment in which like his girlfriend is saying, no one cares about your story. If you have money, you know, capitalism will solve all of our problems. Money doesn't see color. And everything should be fine.
They kind of made that differentiation with that one other black couple in the restaurant.
Yeah.
She was like, oh, it's not that. And that is, I think, a real thing that a lot of, like, when I was younger, my mom used to take me places on purpose that were nowhere near where we lived. Mm-hmm. So that when you go out, you know how to act and you don't do embarrassing stuff like this and, like, think that it's crazy that there's somebody in the bathroom all the time because mm-hmm. you've never been anywhere with a maitre d' or whatever you call them. Like, all of those little nuances that do make you feel self-conscious when you've literally never been there before.
Right.
And like how that's going to manifest later in insecurities is just like, oh boy.
Yeah. And it's interesting. This is a theme that comes up a few times in the series about, especially regarding restaurants. In season 4 with the kids, you see the same thing. But we'll get to that in season 4. But I do love just to say that immediately after her saying, capitalism will solve everything, the symbolism of taking the cake down and not knowing how it works is like, oh wait, no, there are some things money doesn't solve, which is just like there are social codes written in higher society that are just, you know, going to be alien, especially to people who like grew up the way D'Angelo grew up.
Mm-hmm.
They
said let them eat cake, but they didn't give him the specifics on how
they didn't
to,
know which cake that there were some that were sample cakes.
Yeah, you just said to eat the cake. You didn't tell me that there was like a fake cake that
there's
supposed
to too
know
many
the model.
Yes, there's too many rules.
There's so many forks. I don't know where to start with this cake.
I mean, I gotta say, like, even now, the like, thank God there's no like dessert carts at fancy restaurants anymore for the most part. But like, watching it now, I'm like, I don't really understand how the fucking dessert cart thing works. Like,
you point at it.
Yeah. How about
and
I just
then you let them do their job.
Yeah.
I mean, it makes more sense to me to just have it on a picture on a menu, but menus
but
with pictures
like,
on them is like Denny's, and they don't want to be Denny's.
But like, it would be more understandable if he's like, grab the display cake, and they're like, oh no, that's not the one. We have to go to the back to get you the real one. But it's like, no, we have the actual cake here. It's just not that specific cake. But underneath in this other rack, those are the real cakes.
Let me go into the back and get the real cake. Yeah. I like that. It's just like when you go to a shoe store and you go, you got any bigger sizes?
Give me a fresh one.
Yeah,
that
please.
No one's tried on yet.
I don't want anyone that have been tried on. D's storyline ends with the scene with Avon and Dee, in which they are visiting Avon's father, Dee's uncle, in some sort of state hospital facility. And Avon is just talking about how, you know, life is the thing that happens when you're in the game and you end up in a coma. I'm not really sure. Basically, I don't know how he got in a coma, but...
Again, when we showed up there, I was like, am I supposed to know why this man is here?
Yeah, and who this man is?
Yeah, and I also do love that the scene opens with him.
He described the man as D'Angelo's uncle. And this up until now, we've been led to believe that Avon is D'Angelo's uncle. So this guy, I guess, is his great uncle. I don't know. I don't even know.
Because that's what I was trying to say. Is that Avon's father? Would that make that him his great uncle? And then you just call them both uncle?
I think so. That's my guess. I don't know. But I think that's what's going on.
He just treats uncles like cousins. Like, I don't call any of my cousins my second cousins. Like, all their babies are also my cousins. So it's just like all uncles. They're
exactly.
Nobody knows.
So
how
if my cousins are older than me, they're my uncles. If my cousins are younger than me, they're my cousins. It's that's how I work. And then I do like that Avon is, you know, just like, talk that shit now, he says to his dad in a coma.
You never figured on this, did you? Live the life, leave the life, ain't no big thing. He used to talk that shit all the time and he believed it, you know what I'm saying? What's up, baby? Talk that shit now.
It's a surprisingly
just black men not knowing how to show tender. Like, he's holding his hand and like
it is tender.
Living
but
and also I guess that's maybe his own fear talking to him that way. But that was very funny. I was like, what is going on?
I love that too. And then the final storyline, we've talked about most of it. The pager clone is up and running, and there is a code that needs to be cracked. And Prez figures out the code after he like does he takes a phone to a copy machine. and While that's happening, we also find there's some connections between the shot up girl from the last couple of episodes. And turns out basically that Jay Landsman was right, that his fucking,
They have that little Law and Order segment where her friend runs her mouth about every, she like closes her blinds like she's afraid, and then talks to the cops for like 30 minutes.
It is a little, Law and Order-y for sure.
That murder scene still makes no sense. Like, she was out with him, but he also knocked on her window. Like, why wouldn't he just show up and
shoot
her
through?
We don't
know who knocked on the window, right?
Yeah, we do. He said he did.
No, who? D'Angelo said he did.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we're going to maybe find out later that he's not the one who did it.
Got it. Okay.
Yes. But it doesn't matter. It's, I mean, it matters, but hey, this podcast can only go so long. One thing I did love about the whole thing with like Jay Landsman kind of like bragging about, you know, hey, it turned out my murdered lady is part of your case. At one point, McNulty runs up to him and he's in the middle of saying the punchline of a joke, and the punchline is, and the bear said, "You didn't really come here to hunt now, did you?" And just in that moment, a black female police officer just leaves the room disgusted while all the men are laughing.
I miss that.
It's such a small moment. Yeah. And I was just like, I gotta know what the rest of that joke was.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, because I at this point wrote bare ass in the workplace ? Like that guy is playing it fast and loose.
Oh
yeah.
No, he just talked about jerking off to a child in the last episode. So we assume what the joke was.
He set a bar for himself.
He has set a bar. Jay is a disgusting human being. But the ending of this episode with regards to, you know, the whole pager stuff is Freeman comes up to Daniels and basically tells him they need to wire the payphones.
We should have had a tap at Project Payphones by now. A wire there will get us the drugs. Keep pushing, we'll get a whiff of the money too. Now I know you're serious about climbing that career ladder, and I know how slippery it gets the higher you go. But for me, I don't want to go to no dance unless I can rub some tit.
Appreciate your honesty.
Back in the 40s, that's how you got your money.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. Because I was like, what are you like two-stepping and like grabbing nipples? Yeah. Like, how are you rubbing all these tits out at the club?
Yeah. I wonder if he means with his hand, or is it just like brushing against it?
I was imagining a lot of creepy grazing.
Me too. That's what I'm thinking.
Oh, no, I'm thinking palm to tit.
Well, right.
Just full on.
Yeah.
I mean, he makes it sound like dances back in his day was mostly just a tit squeezing fest.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but
that's what the twist was really about.
Yeah, exactly. Do the twist was about nipple tweaking. But in that scene, what I find interesting is that like he is immediately proven right by the next sequence of events that happens. Wallace and Poot see Brandon playing pinball at the Greek spot. Wallace pages D with 911, 911. D calls Wallace back. D pages Sting, tells him about Brandon's string, and String meets Wallace and Poot, who point him out at the Greeks, and they get all of the pages on the computer. They all come through, but like while that is like good evidence to have, if they had had a fucking wiretap on the payphones, they would have gotten the whole thing.
Everybody saying, "Let's go, Brandon," into the phone. Like it would have been.
Yeah, it is like it's crazy how immediate that Freeman is proven to be correct. They should have had a fucking, if they had wiretaps on the payphones, they would have gotten the murder of Brandon. Instead, what they have is kind of circumstantial evidence regarding the murder of Omar's boyfriend, and it's a sad thing because we know that it's not going to be pretty. We see someone has some handcuffs, and we're like, this is going to be more than just a murder.
It looks ominous, and I can't imagine the kind of rage that would come out of Omar, because do you know how many people you have to kill for a whistle to catch on? Like, he's terrifying.
Yeah.
Like, the precedent that this man has set
Yeah, to be able to whistle the farmer in the dell and just like do robberies with children's rhymes and be like, the cheese stands alone.
Yes.
Hi ho, what dare
you? Like you said, the references that he's doing, you know, people half the time don't even know them. They're just confused and afraid.
Yes. They're like, I don't know what he meant by the cheese stands alone, but I'm afraid.
Yeah. I just heard something about the Iliad and then a gun cocked and I ran. I don't even know.
Oh, man. But we will see how he responds to whatever happens in the next episode. If you had to rate this episode, give it like a letter grade, I think I would give it a B+. Vince, what would you give this episode if you had to give it a letter grade?
I give it a solid B+, and I don't know if I'm jumping out of bounds here, but I just wanted to point out that Bird, who we see for the first time,
yes,
in this episode, is played by Fredro Starr of the hip-hop group Onyx.
Yes.
Which,
the first time I watched it, I was like, why the fuck do I know that guy's face so well?
It's Q from Alicia. It
oh, there you
yes,
go.
Yes.
He got some shit done. I was so excited to see him too.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's just great at mean mugging. I mean, the guy has got a wonderful mean mug.
Terrifying. He was terrifying on a sitcom with laugh tracks.
Yes.
He was still scary.
Yeah. It was the only time I ever heard uncomfortable laugh tracks on a sitcom. Katrina, if you had to rate this episode from a scale of, say, B+ to B+, how would you rate this episode?
I think I would give it a B+ because I feel like it's like an A for references like Odell's, which is a club my mom actually went to.
Nice.
And then maybe a C for Nolte calling his wife a cunt, and that gets you back to a B plus.
That's fair. Yeah.
Very teacherly.
Yes. It is a solid B+ episode of The Wire and a solid A+ episode of Pod Yourself. The Wire. Katrina Davis, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always the best time.
I would love to have you back. And is there anywhere where people can find you on the internet?
Yeah, you can find me at Katrina Savad, Sivad. It's just Davis backwards, but my website, my handles on all the internet stuff, everything's the same. And on my website, it has shows and places to watch my special and everything.
Check it out wherever you get your internet.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Katrina. We really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Patreon.com/Frogcast. $8 tier gets you a shout out. Vince, I have a few shout outs for you this week. All right. First one is Colin Coe.
Yeah. Colin Coe Kane. We're going to call this guy Big Daddy Kane.
Big Daddy Kane. Love it. Okay. Mm-hmm. Next is Melissa Ketsukek.
We call her the toucan.
Okay. I like it. That's good.
Just because.
Yeah. Why?
I don't know. That's what her name reminded me of.
Okay. Next is Joanna Robel. I don't know how to pronounce her name. She's Polish. She paid in Polish zlotys. So
I'm gonna assume that's Vrobel then. Maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
Is it?
We're gonna call her Crack Baby. But like,
why?
Not. Well, just crack with K-R-A-K, because like Krakow, like crack, you know, because she's from Poland. Yeah, there we go.
All right. Yeah, you got there. Next is Dan Paradis.
Paradis. Wasn't that, that was Johnny Depp's ex-wife, wasn't it? Paradis. We're going to.
Paradis nuts.
We're going to call this guy Edward Scissorhands.
Okay. All right. Mm-hmm. Four more. Peter Tobiasen.
Oh, well, that guy is the real Viking. Fuck Johnny Weeks.
Yeah, yeah. We're calling him the real Viking. Eric Schultz.
We're going to call, wow. Yeah, we're going to call this guy the Commandant.
Okay.
Sounds German. Well, I was going to go with something Jewish, but then I was like, no.
You could also go German. Like Peanut because of the Peanuts, because of Charles Schultz.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, Snoopy.
All right, we're calling him Snoopy.
Yeah, we'll call him Snoopy. Yeah,
all right. Andy Loy.
Yeah, we're going to call this guy um Loy. That's a, all right. what's the lawyer's name in this show?
Oh, fuck. I don't remember, man. Loy. We call him the lawyer. I don't know. Just say Loy.
Yeah. That's what we're calling him. The lawyer.
Okay. Andy Loy. The lawyer. And finally, yeah. Matt Nyquist.
Yeah, Nyquist. I mean, he's daring me to call him NyQuil, but I'm going to go Mydol with him.
Mydol. Matt Mydol Nyquist. Love
yeah,
it.
Yeah, there we go.
Once again, the $8 tier gets you a shout out and a gangster name. Of course, there are a bunch more that we've gotten, but we can't get to all of them this week. So listen next week where your name might pop up. Patreon.com/Frockcast. Frockcast@gmail.com for all your questions, comments, and concerns. Vince, what is the Google Voice number?
415-275-0030.
All right, everyone. Thanks again so much for listening. And until next time, if you come at the king, you best not miss.
Yeah. Wire Podcast. The world's only Wire Podcast. Yeah, bitch. This is a show about the wire. And it's also about putting out some fires. It's about war on drugs and the war on terror. It's about lots of things, but it's also about cool guys who sell drugs to their friends and their thugs. And everybody's seeing all the things going on, and no one doing nothing, and no one's ever going to win, and the war won't end till everyone tries heroin. It's about schools and people who work at the docks and people who teach in schools and the newspaper guys at the end, and also about drug dealers and also about drug users. And also about McNulty getting a divorce from his wife. He's not a very good dad. And also, he is bad at not drinking a lot. And also, this show is about politicians. It was Obama's favorite show. Sucky, 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 yeah, bitch. TV show to Barack Obama. What's that say about what Obama likes? It either means that he has good taste, or it means that he watched the show and decided to not do anything when he had the power to change things. But whatever, bruh, that's fine. I wouldn't have done it neither. Probably I'd be too scared to do it.
Suck it, 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 suck it. Sucky, 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 on dick. Licky, 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 on clit. Sucky, 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 fucky, sucky, 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 fucky, sucky, 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 suck my dick.
Omar. The Wire. Matt Lee. Guzmantini. Brent Weiberg. David Simon, come on the show. Avon's paranoid, we base not worried all that much. Thanks.
who is a band from Baltimore. I don't have to fucking explain myself. I don't even know who these are for no more, bro. Fuck ye. Fuck ye. Anyways, Panda Bear, great artist, love him.
Anyways, I'm a southern alligator. And, oh boy, do I love me some Cajun cooking. You just give me a last crawl, Dad, and I'll just, ooh, and I'll eat me a crawl, Dad.
I don't know, man. I feel like I'm failing you guys. But I love the harmonies in that song. Okay. See you next week.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.